Thank you very much, Lydia, and thank you to the organizers for inviting me today, and to everyone who has stayed the pace for the day. I speculate that this is a different session. We're going to take a slightly different approach. And I expect as we pursue and strive for the issues of our talent and excellence, and then hearing about areas of new science and so on, yeah, I think it's important. What are the grand challenges facing society and higher education? How do we balance out all these different societal needs as we chase some of that? And in that context, just to put it in terms of maybe three different quotes. One is the first one regards the European Commission and its concern about the ranking of European higher education and the universities, and it's the global ranking vis-a-vis, let's say, the Shanghai academic ranking world universities. The World Bank, General Sami, basically asking the question that if you want to pursue this issue about world-class universities, which seems to be, say something about it, a government objective, we need to do so in clear alignment with national strategies and to avoid distortions about resource allocation. And finally, a quite interesting editorial from the Washington Monthly, which was its own kind of ranking in the US, basically turning the issue on its head, as one of the speakers did this morning in terms of looking at what we're actually measuring. He was talking about small countries, about what are the best, how do we measure the best colleges and universities? And the Washington Monthly is basically saying the colleges that are best are those who work hardest to help economically disadvantaged students earn credentials that the job market demands. So I want to look at four different topics, setting the context, just things we basically know, looking briefly at this obsession with rankings and global rankings, looking at some of the contradictions that seems to me that are emerging, and looking maybe at the shape of things to come. Okay, so we all know this kind of stuff about globalization and its changing nature and how it's forcing a huge change across knowledge-intensive industries, which higher education is clearly a knowledge-intensive industry. And these kinds of shapes about the world order, what I might call the world order, have been intensified by the global financial crisis. Coming from Ireland, we feel it very deeply. These worldwide comparisons, the kind of things that we see coming in rankings, are now being intensified. Everything that we have seen even this morning, or during the day, looking at all kinds of ratings, whether they're for innovation, tech transfer, R&D investment, and so on. And we have increasingly this obsession with the ranking of not just institutions, but of nations. And in this process, institutions and nations are increasingly measured against each other for competitive advantage, and they have an increasing geopolitical implication. Our countries are dependent on talent, and yet many are under demographic pressure. Particularly, if you look at where the world populations are decreasing, and yet where they're increasing, and many of those that are, take the US, which is hugely dependent for its research enterprise, on net emigration of researchers or postdoctoral students. So we have this inherent challenge at the heart of this desire for the knowledge-intensive industry, which is heightening the battle for talent, particularly that for high-achieving students, and yet there are issues also about the labor market for graduates. In response, many governments are basically shaping or what you might more strongly call restructuring their systems and their research systems so that they can better compete. Some are investing very heavily, and we look at those figures all the time, while others are very financially restricted. And because higher education is playing such a key role in the governments, in this competitive new world order, how higher education is organized, how it's measured, what we think about its quality, all these issues about higher education are now at the forefront of public policy. It's no longer that higher education, even in what you might call the private sector or whatever in the U.S., again, to take that as an example, the government use of Pell Grants is driving change across higher education systems. And these, as I said, are having a profound impact on higher education, the way it's organized, and driving, which I'll say a bit more about, a clear and increasing differentiation between private, or those that are less publicly dependent and elite institutions, between public and mass institutions, between public and private systems and how these systems are organized, and fundamentally between nations, challenging and reshaping the world order. We think of that world order often in terms of trade, GDP, and so on. We see that same reshaping going on in higher ed, and again, I was referencing to that throughout the day. Now, some of this has been led, as we know, or increasingly by this, what I would call this obsession with global rankings. Rankings have focused on the characteristics and performance of the top 100 institutions, and yet, according to the International Association of Universities, which is associated with UNESCO, there are 17,000 institutions in the world. And the top of the conversation at forums such as this or at other governmental ones is on the top 100, less than 1% of all institutions. And these so-called world class, or we use this term world class, are seen as a panacea for success in the future. So these global rankings reflect at one level the realization that in the global economy, national preeminence or national success is no longer sufficient and we need to operate on a global level. They appear to be a way of measuring success, and yet one might step back and look at the criteria or the indicators. They defined a level of excellence using their certain kinds of their indicators. They've also challenged self-perceptions of excellence, so self-declaration. You know, countries who say, or institutions or academics who say, I'm fantastic, rankings expose that. But it's also true of nations. And that is very clear about how, let's say, very European nations thought of themselves. Germany is a good example, who has lived for a long time thinking they were great, and then the rankings came out, or the European Union, and then the rankings came out, and they said, oh my gosh, what's really happening here? So in response, we've got this incredible policy shock going on and a frenzy about changes in higher education systems and research systems. And this is a kind of thing that's coming out, this kind of graph of looking at rankings and where countries sit in here. These are just the different kinds of rankings that are out there. First one is the Times Higher QS ranking that ceased to exist in 2009. Then there's the Shanghai Academic Ranking of World Universities. And now we have the new ones, the new QS and the new Times Higher, Times and Reuters one. And essentially, what I've done is I've just, as everyone does, is I've just counted up the top 100 because this is what governments look at, and I want to know where do we sit, what kind of battle are there. It's an absolute obsession in higher educational policy circles as to whether Oxford or Harvard are at top and so on. And yet, as I say, we've 17,000 institutions in the world. So it seems to me that what we've got is an exposure of a range of contradictions. We have the cost of pursuing the world-class model estimated for a single institution, a bare minimum of $2 billion a year, more than the entire Irish higher education budget, I would say, for a single institution. And yet there's a cost of sustaining universal higher education. That's universal meaning that more than 50% of your population is going to higher education. The cost of mass higher education is now quite extensive, and governments are asking, can we afford it? There's greater dependence on higher education. We want higher education to do more, to provide more, to have a bigger impact on society. And yet many of these world classes drive for world class institutions. They're increasingly unfettered by the nation state, delinked from the nation state, and privatized in the way they behave and operate outside of the nation state. We have this concentration of excellence, this concentration of talent, this drive of concentration that the funding and resource allocation should go to a few institutions. The French President Nicolas Sarkozy said we have 80 odd universities, we're hardly going to fund them all. And yet, on the other hand, we have a desire and a policy need to enhance human capital potential of all our citizens and enhance regional capacity. We have an increasing drive by this emphasis on research and research excellence, and it's differentiating and driving a division between research and teaching in our universities. And at the same time, we know that students learn better when they're informed by a rich research-informed environment, where we need a closer integration of teaching and research. We measure research in terms of very traditional outputs, and we have them up here in terms of citations and peer review. But at the same time, we know that increasingly research is not something done in isolated labs, and increasingly research is done by a wider community, it's co-produced with users, it's use-informed, and we are moving increasingly to what I might call social or public accountability. So we continue as an academic community in the higher education and our research councils to reward traditional academic outputs, and yet we're at the same time wanting to see that higher education research makes a bigger impact, that we're involved in knowledge transfer, that we have a social impact and benefit for the research that we're doing. So just a few of these. Here's a graph, a UNESCO graph, looking at the huge drive in the demand for higher education. It's by region, but you see just generally going up this enormous drive for the numbers of people, this unlimited demand for higher education. Essentially at the basis of you need a university a week to provide for the numbers of people who are now looking for higher education, who are coming on in terms of the demographic needs. And yet, this whole push about global rankings is forcing us down an issue of, like I said, we're focusing on the top 100 institutions, where we've got, you know, this emphasis on a super league of elite institutions that are extremely well endowed, with huge endowments, these very small staff-student ratios, and a focus increasingly on competing so that our countries will be up there in those global rankings. And this emerging global model of this kind of world-class, looking at this small number of elite institutions, we see a lot of governments pumping their resources into it. We can look at France, Germany, excellence initiatives, the desire from both Russia and France to create its own Ivy League. We have Spain, China, we can go around the world. As to the numbers of countries who are pursuing similar type objectives. The US states, individual states competing on the same level, using the tier one concept, which comes from US News and World Report. This emerging global model is based on the top 100, as I said. It's got a mission that transcends the nation state, so the nation state becomes less important. It's delinked from it. It's the intensification of knowledge production amongst a few. Diversified funding, clearly not dependent on the state, and operating worldwide. But as I said, this kind of model that we are is putting out there as the model for which we, as government policy level, should follow, is happening at a time when, in fact, as societies, we actually need more and more from higher education. There's a greater demand, and we are demanding more of it. The world-class model is increasingly, as I would say, unfettered from the nation state, arguably unresponsive because it's not dependent, diversifying its funding, which is what we want it to do, recruiting talent internationally, and engaging globally. In fact, ironically, the types of institutions that are feted and rewarded in the global rankings are probably are the most research and resource intensive and probably the least efficient.
So when we look at some of the internal contradictions of what we're applauding, we need to step ourselves back. And it's not obvious that the elite model of knowledge creation will affect be able to provide a sustainable knowledge society for everyone. So we look at two kinds of models that we see now emerging. One is this hierarchically differentiated one, and we could refer to this as countries as well, but changing names, where we've got different countries hierarchically differentiated, the kind of Harvard 2 model. The other one looks at a more horizontally differentiated model, where institutions do different things and we recognize a portfolio of institutions providing for the range of different people within our societies, providing a range of knowledge and skills. Another kind of contradiction is this notion, again, about how we measure and we reward or we value research, and we generally the simple method, which has tended to be the way things are done, is that we count peer publications and citations. You know, it's kind of, you know, the Google thing, standing on the shoulders of giants. And we use these bibliometric databases, and it was interesting earlier, again, one of the speakers basically saying, well, the social sciences are here, but then it was only a fraction of the percentage of the social sciences that actually recorded this way. So effectively, when we measure this data and then it reproduces itself in these global rankings, we're really only looking at some parts of knowledge. So we're in effect that some knowledge is more important than others. Certainly the humanities are missing from it. And okay, this is a form that's really looking probably more at the physical and life sciences, but we live in a world in which many of the challenges that confront us are ones that deal with human behavior and not just a scientific solution. We have problems because they discount things that aren't written in English, which refer to all kinds of really important problems that deal with social and local problems. And we ultimately ignore by the way in which things are measured, by ignoring the wider social and economic value and impact of research and what it's producing. So accountability occurs only within the academy and not within society more broadly. And yet we're demanding more from higher education. And just to indicate what I mean by that is if you look at this table, what I'm suggesting here is that what we're measuring it only is what's above the line. We measure journal articles and peer esteem. And yet, when we look at the range of outputs, whether it's in book chapters, software, publications, policy implications, and so on, none of that is taken into account, either in an academic progression, promotion, the way in which we measure through rankings. Nor do we consider the other ways in which knowledge actually should be impacting, either on teaching, on the environment, on changes in lifestyle. To what extent have we spent a lot of money in particular scientific issues, and have they actually had an impact on changes in people's lives? So is the pendulum beginning to swing? Are there other questions being asked? There are countries that are beginning to say that what we really need to be doing is supporting the system as a whole, not just focusing our attention on what one group, the Lisbon Council in Brussels, called producing hordes of Nobel laureates, with all due respect to our colleagues here, and cabals of tenure and patent-bearing professors. We need to look more broadly at the needs of society, policy beyond the elite. And the European Union has a way of which it has described this in terms of the knowledge triangle. Nature has asked itself and has spent an issue in which it questioned the many scientists and researchers living, working in universities in the heart of cities who were not turning their attention to the problems of the city to which they were living in and were focused on other issues, and yet they were living and breathing within the city in which they live. The U.S. Carnegie Foundation for Teaching and Learning has been gone a way of classifying institutions by what it calls engagement, to to what extent are universities engaged beyond the lab? The EU is looking at a ranking in which it's looking at a range of criteria, and the OECD is trying to measure learning outcomes. So there are some initiatives on the way. Here's a version of the EU's knowledge triangle, in which what I'm saying here is that higher education sits between three different issues. It's the education and learning, the research and discovery, but it's the innovation and engagement. It's a wider sphere in which higher education now sits, which is quite different than traditional models of either the traditional university, the vocational institution, or indeed the research institution. This is what we call the civil society agenda. The one that looks beyond the campus itself and looks at the way in which higher education is interacting as a whole with the society in which it's part of. And increasingly, we know that higher education is part of an ecosystem. It co-produces knowledge. It's a range of people in which success is based not on a single institution, but on a range and a portfolio of institutions providing a range of different needs. So what's the shape of things to come? One, we know higher education is competitive and that globalization has forced this new urgency, and particularly in the shift of the world order and particularly in the context of the global financial crisis. This demand is pushing up this demand for higher education and the goods, if you want to say the goods and services of knowledge society, is pushing up the status of elite institutions and their nations. And because it's coming to the point where governments are now questioning, how can we fund this demand? How do we fund all post-secondary education? Some governments are making an insidious connection between excellence and exclusiveness. There are powerful forces, I'd say, pushing a return to what I call elite models of knowledge production conducted by a handful of institutions that will receive the bulk of funding. And we see increasingly a division between, I mentioned it earlier, between private, very selective research elite universities on the one hand, and the others that are your public, recruiting all comers, teaching mass-based and less well-funded institutions, and switch it from institutions to nations. And we see increasingly these divisions occurring. Today, higher education does need to learn to survive in a very complex and competitive environment. No doubt quality and excellence are the two key mantras. And it is open to scrutiny from a wide range of stakeholders, and this is inevitable and will grow. National prominence is no longer sufficient, and survival is no longer guaranteed. Indeed, if one needs only look at some of the Chronicle of Higher Education, which is the U.S. Bible on higher education news, to see small colleges disappearing. But at the same time, it seems to me it's time to adopt a new paradigm. Success is not in countries and in our nations is not the result of a single flagship university, but rather that knowledge operates in an ecosystem in which we have a diverse range of institutions in wider society with a wide range of people in a distributed knowledge production system. And it's this is that lays the best foundation for maximizing the capability of society as a whole beyond the individual. Thank you very much.